Could have had him any day. They only let him hang around out of kindness, I suppose.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Texas Monthly Magazine, followed by Travelin' Texas at 4.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Watering schedule. The City of Midland has adjusted the lawn and landscaping watering schedule, which will allow residents to water 4 days a week instead of two. Even-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and odd-numbered addresses can water on Sunday, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 60 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 3 p.m.
It's in Texas Monthly. Howdy, welcome to our program. I'm Casey Dobin. This is Texas Monthly Magazine on site and sound broadcasting, and our first article will be from our brand new February issue. We're going to go right to one of our cover stories. This is a feature article, not the cover story, it's a feature article. It's entitled The Unsheltered. For more than 2 years, culminating in a pandemic and a recession, Richard Sherem photographed Dallas families who are experiencing homelessness, the moments of great pain and frustration, and through it all, the moments of levity. It starts with car problems, an emergency medical procedure, or a lost job. If there are any savings, they go fast. There's a missed payment or two, then a repossession or an eviction. Obstacles overlap and compound quickly. Once the car has been repossessed, getting to work can take hours, a commute that is tenable for only so long. With no income, rent goes unpaid. With no fixed address, filing for unemployment and applying for jobs become impossible. Parents experiencing homelessness are faced with even greater challenges. In addition to figuring out where their families might sleep on any given night, maybe a car if it's not too cold out, maybe a motel if it is, maybe a shelter if there's room, maybe the street if there's no other choice, parents also need to get their kids to school. Sometimes school is the only stable part of these kids' lives, says photographer Richard Sherem, who for more than 2 years chronicled the day-to-day of families in Dallas without fixed addresses. A lot of these families have lost everything. Getting a child to school on time becomes one of the most important moments of the day. At the Family Gateway Shelter in downtown Dallas, where Sherem spent most of his time, nearly all the children attend public school. U.S. Department of Education estimates that more than 230,000 public school students in Texas did not have a, quote, fixed, regular, adequate nighttime address, unquote, at some point during the 2017-2018 school year, the most recent period for which data is available. That's about 3% of public school students in the state. More than half those students were doubled up, meaning they shared a residence with another family. About 20,000 were staying in hotel or motel rooms, and about 20,000 were residing in shelters. More than 50,000 were described as unsheltered. These children and their parents shared their lives with Sherem, the pivotal moments and the mundane. Despite the circumstances, over and over, he photographed kids just being kids. And he photographed parents trying to do what almost all parents try to do, what's best for their children. Most of the parents he met through Family Gateway were either employed or actively looking for jobs. Some had medical issues that prevented them from working. Others could not work because they were caring for children with special needs who required full-time supervision. These families have experienced things that could happen to almost anyone, Sherem says. As the coronavirus crept across Texas and the state's unemployment rate rose to almost 14%, Sherem continued shooting, capturing new layers of isolation and institutionalization. He watched as the pandemic aggravated the labyrinthine bureaucracies parents encounter as they try to apply for jobs, file for unemployment, and provide for their families. I've seen people spend hours on the phone on hold just trying to talk to someone about getting new birth certificates because theirs were lost during an eviction, Sherem says. They might be on hold for 3 hours before the line just disconnects. That's not rare at all. Family Gateway, a nonprofit organization that accepts donations and welcomes volunteers, operates one of a few family-friendly shelters in the Dallas area. And even before the pandemic, every room was occupied most nights of the year. During peak times, overflow space was needed. Now, more Texans are likely to experience homelessness. Data collected by the U.S. Census Bureau in mid-November indicates that over 700,000 Texans are facing eviction or foreclosure through January of 2021. Federal moratorium on evictions that protected tenants from September through December has since been extended to January 31st. After the pandemic, as so many of us attempt to restart our normal lives, many of these families will still be rebuilding theirs. A six-year-old girl gazes into an imaginary camera lens. "Hello, guys," she says. "Welcome back to my channel. My name is Caden, but you can call me KK." Smoothly explains that in today's video, she'll be reviewing slime. It's mid-February 2020, 3 weeks before COVID-19 will change life for everyone here. A few feet away, in her cramped room at Family Gateway's shelter, Caden's mother, 25-year-old Whitney Bryant, cracks up. "I don't know where she gets this stuff," Bryant says. Caden has dreams of becoming a YouTube star. Her mom often sees her walking around, talking to herself, as if she's streaming to millions of followers. Sometimes, Caden introduces her audience to a doll or stuffed animal, or she'll share a lesson from school, a few words in Spanish, a few numbers in Chinese. She'll tell her public a joke she'd heard, like, "Girls go to college to get more knowledge, boys go to Jupiter to get more stupider." Recently, her segments have featured a friend Caden has made at the shelter, 7-year-old Miracle. Of course, you guys know Miracle. She'll be joining us for today's video. Miracle wants to be a TikTok star, so when they finish filming the YouTube clip, the girls begin shooting an imaginary TikTok video of themselves dancing to a song nobody else in the room can hear. The dance involves a lot of flailing feet. Caden is the oldest of Bryant's 4 kids. Youngest is 3 weeks old. In the mornings, before the bus arrives to take her to school, Caden often picks out clothes for the infant. When she gets home, she'll hold the baby for a while to give her mom a break. "She can sense when I'm struggling," Bryant says. Sometimes it's tense, with 5 of them living in a single room in a noisy shelter. "It can all feel like too much," Bryant says. "A lost job, an eviction, car trouble, family problems, on top of all the worries that come with raising young kids. Her thoughts race, and she has difficulty focusing." Then she hears Caden making another video. "Welcome back, guys. I'm so glad you could join me today." Patrick Buckner wasn't used to doing his 12-year-old daughter Devaya's hair. The first few times, it took him more than 3 hours. Now he has it down to a science. As he stands behind her in their room at Family Gateway's shelter, his fingers turn so fast they're hard to track. With machine-like proficiency, he takes a tuft and twists it into a perfect curl. All the while, he tells the story of how they got here, a story Devaya has never heard before. She's sitting in a chair, tapping the screen of an old iPad Buckner's mother gave them, playing a colorful game called Tiles. When Buckner begins gesturing, Devaya silently reaches for one of his hands and places it back on her head. He and Devaya's mother split up when she was a baby, and he didn't return to his daughter's life until she was 8, when he learned she was in foster care. He petitioned for custody and flew to Tennessee to get her, to bring her back to Texas to live with him. "When I saw her smile," he says, "I'd never felt anything like that." He loved being with Devaya, loved playing basketball with her, watching her make tiny clothing for her dolls, and seeing her grades rise from Fs to As and Bs. He even came to love twisting his daughter's hair into tiny curls. He felt guilty for all the years he hadn't been around. He wanted to give her everything, a nice apartment with nice furniture, internet, and a good television with cable. He couldn't afford it all working at a fast food restaurant, and the bills piled up. They lost the apartment, the furniture, and the TV. They'd been homeless for more than a year. Buckner had a job at UPS until last March when he was laid off. Devaya goes to school in Richardson. Buckner says it's important to keep some things consistent. Sometimes they walk to the library and look for books to read together. Other days they take a train to run errands. Some days they stay in the room and Buckner does Devaya's hair she taps away on the iPad. "We'll be out of here soon," he says, gesturing emphatically. "We won't be back." Without looking up from the screen, Devaya grabs his hand and returns it to her head. Seated on a brown couch in a corner of the living room in his new apartment in North Dallas, Patrick Johnson, 49, watches a college football game on TV featuring two teams he doesn't care about. He never imagined life like this. This couch is where Johnson's four children, the youngest 8 and the oldest 14, curl up to gaze in the glow of their phones. It is often a garage for toy race cars. Other times, it's where the family eats dinner. On a Saturday morning when the kids are still asleep, the couch is where Johnson can watch the fuzzy broadcast of a football game. That TV is one of the few things he took from his last apartment, the home his family shared for 11 years. Clothes, blankets, a few important documents, and this television. Johnson worked in the Richardson Parks and Recreation Department, emptying public trash cans. In March, Johnson says, when the pandemic brought Texas to a standstill, he was told his services were no longer needed. He says his wife, to whom he was married for 25 years, told him something similar. She left him to take care of the kids by himself. He missed his rent payment in April, then again in May and June. In July, a few days after the nationwide moratorium on evictions expired, the property manager told him he needed to vacate. He couldn't take his table or his couch, couldn't take his dishes or his microwave. Most of what he left went into the trash. At first, the five of them lived with Johnson's sister. Then, when his unemployment payment came through, the family moved to a cheap motel in North Dallas. A few weeks later, they came to Family Gateway's shelter, one of the few in Dallas that don't separate families. In most shelters, men and women sleep in different parts of the building. He remembers his kids telling him to stop crying. After a few weeks at the shelter, the family moved into their current apartment. For a few months, Family Gateway will cover their rent as part of the shelter's supportive housing assistance. Then Johnson will be expected to pay an increasingly greater share. When he's got his head above water, he'll cover the full amount. "We'll never take anything for granted," he said. "I never thought I'd be without a home." Now, though, the family has a place of their own again, somewhere the kids can see their friends again. Patrick Johnson and his family have a new start. Next, we're turning back to last month's issue. We have a few things left in the state. This is The Culture. It's music by Melissa Guetta. Its title for January is Divine Sounds. San Juan's beloved mariachi choir draws faithful fans even during the pandemic. At the Basilica of Our Lady of San Juan de Valle, soaring ceilings and geometric stained glass windows surround a sanctuary where roughly 3,500 devotees gather. The church has long functioned as the heart of the Catholic community in the Rio Grande Valley. Even with social distancing precautions in place, the faithful remain present at the house of worship. When its limited allotment of indoor seats is filled, attendees sit outside on a terrace fitted with speakers while others watch the live-streamed Mass from home. Since 1985, visitors from around the world have made the pilgrimage to San Juan to hear the stylings of the Basilica's famous mariachi group. Hailing from the valley and from Nuevo León, Mexico, the 13 members, clad in traditional embroidered regalia trimmed with silver and gold botonaduras, sing and play devotional music year-round. Christmas carols, pastorelas, Easter songs, and popular hymns are given mariachi arrangements for the bilingual liturgy by musical director Francisco Morales. One Day at a Time, Sweet Jesus, composed in 1974 by Mary John Wilkin and Brownsville native Chris Christopherson, is a basilica favorite, known in its Spanish language adaptation as Un Día de la Vez. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the group performed in 9 masses every weekend. Now they sing for 3 masses each Sunday, with some of them appearing in alternate weeks. The spacious church allows them to perform with a safe distance between themselves and far from worshipers, too. Because of travel restrictions, only the 6 choir members who live on the U.S. side of the border are available to play, so that musicians currently hesitate to describe themselves as a traditional mariachi, Morales emphasizes. Still, they sing. Even a pandemic can't stop the music. Next up, in state. This is news and politics. It's a profile by Daniel Oppenheimer. Can Trumpism transcend Trump? Dallas intellectual Gladden Pappin thinks so. He's urging Republicans to build a big tent, big spending party that's economically populist and socially conservative. Gladden Pappin's last task before he headed off to an election night party on November 3rd was to teach an undergraduate class on Marsilius of Padua, a 14th century Italian critic of the papacy. Papin ended by hinting at the subject of his next lecture, The Great Schism, 4 decades of late 14th and early 15th century when rival popes battled for control of the church. It was an era of crumbling institutions, political realignment, and deep anxiety. a resonant topic, in other words, for our times, and good grist for Pappin, 38-year-old assistant professor of politics at the University of Dallas and a rising star in the American conservative intellectual firmament. On Thursday, I came into class after the election, says Pappin, and I said to the students, "So you're living with a few days of uncertainty. Imagine living with 40 years of not knowing who the Pope is at a time in the Middle Ages when that's incredibly important." In the aftermath of the election, Pappin has been puzzling through what path conservatism might take after Donald Trump's presidency. The endeavor is part of Pappin's major project for the past 4 years, ever since he first came onto the scene as one of the pseudonymous writers of the Journal of American Greatness, a pro-Trump blog that launched in early 2016. He's been using the tools of political theory and history to parse the meaning of Trump and the deep political and cultural forces that brought him to power and continue to support him. Pappin has been plotting out and even trying to help write the next chapter of the conservative movement. What he sees in Trump's 2016 victory and the results of the 2020 election and in more subterranean shifts in conservative politics is the possibility of a new kind of Republican Party. It is one that is economically populist, culturally conservative, multiracial, cautious about the use of military power, and above all, comfortable with the exercise of state power. It's a big government conservatism in both the economic and cultural spheres, more generous with social benefits, more prudish about sex, and more Christian in atmospherics, if not in explicit doctrine. The base is already there, says Pappin, who is working on a book on the future of the American right. It's broader even than what the Republicans can appeal to right now. Trump's loss was a disappointment for Pappin, but he sees it as a best-case loss scenario. President did not secure a second term, but there were meaningful signals of discontent with both the Republican and Democratic establishments. Voters in Florida supported Republican candidates and also a ballot initiative that raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Voters in Deep Blue California elected to uphold the state's ban on affirmative action, barring officials from considering race, ethnicity, and gender in college admissions, hiring, and the awarding of contracts. Nationally, Trump did better with people of color, particularly black and Latino voters, than he did in 2016. Trump lost, in other words, but it's not clear that Trumpism lost. I think that a lot of working-class voters were attracted to Trump's championing of them, says Pappin. Question is whether Republicans can find someone who seems like a champion who's more effective and less self-destructive than Trump. Gladden John Pappin was, in many ways, born to become a conservative intellectual. His father is a citizen of the Osage Nation, convert to Catholicism, and a professor of philosophy whose scholarly specialty was the 18th century conservative thinker Edmund Burke. His mother was raised as a Southern Baptist and earned a doctorate in music from Louisiana State University. Born in St. Louis, Gladden and his younger sister followed their parents to various college campuses across the South and Southwest. Books, ideas, family, music, and faith were the air the children breathed. As a 10 or 11-year-old, I knew my father was seriously reading and studying the philosophy of John Paul II, said Pappin. It was a standard Catholic household, but a household of professors. I thought academia was the only profession. As an undergraduate at Harvard University, Pappin joined the staff of the Harvard Salient, a conservative student newspaper, and cut a distinctive figure on campus, playing the role of high Tory dissident from the liberal student mainstream. A 2003 profile of him in the Harvard Crimson features a photo of the then 20-year-old wearing a three-piece suit and bow tie. During his 12 years at school, he stayed on to earn a PhD in political theory. He plugged into the network of institutions, funders, and publications that over the past 50 years has developed an effective pipeline for cultivating young conservative thinkers. It was through both Harvard and this national network, including the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, that Pappin connected with many of the thinkers and writers who had formed the nucleus of the Journal of American Greatness and its successor publication, American Affairs. He was incredibly funny, remembers Mark Henry, a longtime conservative movement leader who recruited Pappin, then a graduate student, to teach summer seminars for the ISI. In particular, Henry recalls Pappin doing a 20-minute reading of a raunchy Tupac Shakur album in the style of Leo Strauss, the German-American philosopher beloved among certain swaths of the political right. It was plausible. It even had Straussian numerology. What united Pappin with many of his fellow conservative travelers as he went from Harvard to academic jobs at a series of Catholic institutions was a growing dissatisfaction with the GOP establishment. One of his gripes was that Republican candidates would whip up culture war hysteria to get elected and then do little about issues such as abortion, gay rights, and pornography. Pappin and his confreres are also taking an unusually hard look at the economic, technological, and environmental order that the Republicans, even more than the Democrats, have ushered into being. Was this a society that was structured for the good of its citizens, they asked, or for its corporations, their shareholders, and the managerial elite who ran them? And if the latter, then was the answer for conservatives to keep promoting small government, or the opposite, to start imagining a big government that was both conservative in the values it promoted and economically redistributive? February of 2016, the same month that Trump began his romp through the Republican primaries, Pappin and a few close friends launched the Journal of American Greatness, adopting ancient Roman pseudonyms to protect their jobs and friendships. It was acidly humorous about the troubles of conservatism incorporated, says Henry, who blogged under the pen name Petronius. The writers were people of the right of center who were discontented with the institutional expression of right of center politics in America. The tone was both highbrow and high drama. Trump was deployed as a character in the story, sometimes a hero, sometimes a fool, representing larger historical forces. For his post, Papen chose the nom de guerre Manlius Capitolinus, a reference to Marcus Manlius Capitolinus, a 4th century BC Roman hero who, according to legend, saved Rome from the Gauls, championed the plebs among the Roman elite, and was eventually condemned to death by the Senate for being a giant pain in the ass. Unexpectedly, the Journal of American Greatness took off, helped in particular by a mention from columnist Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal. Turned out there was an appetite for a frontal assault on a conservative establishment that lent an air of scholarly depth and critical clarity to the chaotic and vulgar Trump candidacy. In an often very long, dense post, Pappin and his fellow bloggers criticized GOP positions on trade, big finance, health care, income inequality, foreign policy, and a host of other issues. More broadly, they told a story of an elite class that was clueless about the struggles of regular Americans and that needed drastic reformation or replacement. We expected that Trump would lose the general election and that there would be a big fight in the GOP over what would happen next, remembers Julius Krein, who blogged as Plautus and with Pappin co-founded both the Journal of American Greatness and American Affairs. The thought at the time was that we would urge resistance to the return of a Paul Ryan, Mitt Romney-style orthodoxy. But the most widely read piece by a member of the American Greatness cohort was published elsewhere in the Claremont Review of Books, by another conservative outlet, written by Michael Anton, a Republican strategist who blogged for the Journal of American Greatness as Publius Decius Mus. The Flight 93 election gave voice to a broad feeling on the right that Trump, for all his flaws, was the one candidate who seemed to grasp the stakes of the election. It also vented an anger simmering in the party's base at establishment Republicans who didn't share their view that a Clinton victory could represent an end to the American Republic. As Trump's campaign fortunes continued to rise, Pappin and his fellow bloggers, including Anton, who went on to serve in the Trump administration, became more convinced that they were onto something. The Trump phenomenon was important, but they also worried that they were becoming too popular to remain anonymous. Some days traffic would exceed 50,000 hits, and among their readers were many of the biggest players in conservative media. Mainstream conservative publications such as National Review and the Weekly Standard frequently covered Pappin's crowd. Most of the people contributing were fairly concerned that they might lose their jobs over it, said Krein, who at the time was working at a hedge fund in Boston. In June of 2016, they shut down the blog. Pappin won't say who made the call, in part to protect the identities of the blog's contributors, half of whom remain anonymous. Pappin had accepted a tenure-track position at the University of Dallas, a small Catholic college in Irving, with long-standing ties to the American conservative movement. He wasn't worried about losing his job, but he recognized, as did Krein, an opportunity to build something more serious and less Trumpy than the Journal of American Greatness. The result, which debuted not long after Trump's inauguration, was American Affairs, a quarterly print magazine and website that made an instant splash with profiles in The New Yorker, The Nation, and Politico, and a launch party at the Harvard Club that attracted a who's who of conservative eminences. Magazine, which has emerged in the years since as the single most vital publication of new conservative and sometimes liberal ideas in America, is much more sober in tone and aesthetics than a Journal of American Greatness. It brands itself instead as a forum for people who believe that the conventional partisan platforms are no longer relevant to the most pressing challenges facing our country. The editors and board of advisors lean heavily right, and the editors have fostered connections to semi-populist right-wing figures and possible Trump heirs, such as Senators Marco Rubio of Florida and Josh Hawley of Missouri. But the politics of its contributors have become much more heterogeneous since it launched. What its writers and editors tend to share is skepticism about neoliberal economics, an aversion to knee-jerk militarism, a root and branch concern of the supposed decadence of American culture, and a willingness to radically rethink the institutions of government. magazine has also made deliberate efforts to shed any lingering associations with Trump. Klein voted for Trump in 2016, but very publicly denounced him after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August of 2017, writing an op-ed in the New York Times, "I voted for Trump, and I sorely regret it." Papen's own stance has been more ambivalent. He didn't publicly endorse a candidate in 2016 or 2020, and he's been careful in his writing to put a lot of distance between myself and the MAGA world, which does trade in a politics of nostalgia and resentment. At the same time, he voted for Trump in both elections and doesn't see him as a sufficient disgrace or threat to merit repudiating. I do believe in politics are either left or right in our world, and so is someone on the right. I want the right to win. Papen's focus in American affairs has been to game out a theoretical framework for big government conservatism and to articulate some of the policy reforms that would follow, including tighter restrictions on access to pornography, an overhaul of the Senate that would assign seats to representatives of business sectors rather than states, and much more aggressive efforts to strategically protect and foster key American industries. Papen's signature proposal, laid out in his American Affairs essay, Affirming the American Family, is what he and his co-author call family pay. The program would encourage childbearing, marriage, and stay-at-home parenting by giving every married couple in the country $6,500 a year for one child, $11,500 for two, and $17,000 for three, with additional incentives for couples who adopt. It's a fascinating glimpse at a vision of more redistributionist but also more culturally conservative nature that doesn't fit comfortably into either the current party's platforms, a reshuffling that Trump sometimes seemed to promise when he was campaigning but then failed to advance once in office. Its more obvious analogs are Christian democratic parties in Western Europe and culturally nationalist parties in Hungary and Poland. One question for Papen and his colleagues, perhaps the question, is whether Trump's failure to deliver on his populist rhetoric was mainly his fault or that of the Republican Party. Did Trump's lack of discipline doom the reforms he campaigned on, or was there simply never going to be room in the party of Mitch McConnell and the Koch brothers for deviations from Republican orthodoxy? And if not, why would that ever change? It's not clear to me who they think is going to do this, says Samuel Goldman, a libertarian-minded conservative who's been sparring with Papen since they were at Harvard together. I cannot imagine a future in which the Chamber of Commerce is not an important part of the Republican Party. As long as that's the case, it's hard to imagine the comprehensive shift they're talking about. Not to say that there shouldn't be some rebalancing, but I think that the talk of a working-class party is exaggerated at best. Jeffrey Kataservis, an anti-Trump conservative who's the director of political studies at the Niskanen Center, a right-leaning Washington, D.C. think tank, sees the same dilemma. At this point, the Republican Party represents the working class for whom these kinds of proposals would have the greatest appeal and do the most help, he says, and yet the party is in the control of the donor class to whom this is anathema. Where is it going to go? To the relatively few people who pay the bills, or to the many? My bet is on the donor class. Kataservis, who is the author of Rule and Ruin, The Downfall of Moderation and the Destruction of the Republican Party, From Eisenhower to the Tea Party, is also skeptical that Papen and his crew have traveled as far from Trump as they allege. I think, he says, they are part of this intellectual sphere which is trying to put a post hoc rationalization for Trumpism upon the Trumpian project. Take a little natural break here and remind you, you're listening to Texas Monthly Magazine on Psych and Sound Broadcasting. This year marks over 50 years of enriching the lives of individuals with visual, physical, and perceptual disabilities. You can listen to Sight into Sound on one of our specially tuned radios, channel 8.5 on TV, streaming on your computer or mobile device, or listening at your convenience on our archives page. We are Sight into Sound Radio since 1967. We now return to our text. Papen is not naive about the future of his party or movement. If something like his vision succeeds, it will be the work of years or decades and will depend not just on charismatic new political candidates, but on the education and training of hundreds of thousands of mid-level functionaries, legislative aides, think tank analysts, committee staffers, who can translate the big ideas into the minutiae of policy. It will depend, above all, on new allegiances of donors and corporate interests. Economic power wins in this country, he says, and until we have some sectors of economic power aligned with the national interest, then you won't really see the realignment. Papen argues, however, that assuming things will go on as they have before can be as mistaken as assuming they will dramatically change. America's past is rich with realignments, and thinkers have often played a role in shaping them. The history of the modern right, in particular, demonstrates how powerful ideas can be, along with those who articulate and disseminate them. From post-war anti-communists like Whittaker Chambers and James Burnham, to William F. Buckley, the National Review, to the neoconservatives in the George W. Bush administration, who championed the invasion of Iraq after 9/11, intellectuals have played important roles in shaping policy, often in the shadow of or in concert with more jingoistic politics. Politics always changes at the margins, says Pappin. The big hulking institutions, they keep the order, but they don't make the changes. I think that the MAGA stuff swept aside at the D.C. level, without Bannon crawling around, we will be able to get more serious. Perhaps the best evidence that big government conservatism has a future is our crisis-prone present. It's COVID-19 and Hurricane Harvey and George Floyd. Big shocks to the system are going to keep coming, and nothing in the recent American past suggests that shrinking the state is likely to be the outcome, whichever party is in power. The question, Pappin believes, is whether the right will continue to grow the state grudgingly and reactively as it has in response to COVID-19, or whether it will drop its small government rhetoric and ideology and instead embrace the big. Author of this column is Daniel Oppenheimer, and he also wrote Far From Respectable, Dave Hickey and His Art, forthcoming from the University of Texas Press in June 2021. Next up, still in state, from January, we have News and Politics. This is Medicine by Rachel Fairbank. What happened to my child? In Houston, families who have spent decades puzzled by their adult children's disabilities are finally getting answers. When Kathleen Stallworth's son, Kyle, was about 6 weeks old, she started noticing something wasn't right. He didn't look at us, he didn't smile, and he had some weird eye movements, she said. Our pediatrician thought he was blind. When at 5 months, Kyle's development continued to be delayed, Kathleen and her husband, Daryl, were puzzled, as their two older sons were high-achieving students. Kathleen enrolled Kyle in therapy. Every week, she made the traffic clog 30-mile drive to Houston's downtown area so Kyle could have sessions at a cerebral palsy treatment center, which offered the closest fit for the treatment he needed. Although his struggles created difficulties for the family, the Stallworths were in a better position than most to provide Kyle with what he needed. Daryl worked for what was then called Texas Department of Mental Health and Mental Retardation, and Kathleen worked for a nonprofit that provided cochlear implants for deaf children. Stallworths were well-educated. They had resources at their disposal, including health insurance, savings, and an awareness of how to navigate the system. Yet even with these advantages, getting the right care for Kyle was tremendously difficult. Because there was no diagnosis, nobody really knew what the deal was, Kathleen said. At first, Kyle's progress toward the benchmarks set by a cerebral palsy therapist was hit or miss. His development didn't look anything like that of other patients. The therapist might set a goal for him to sit up within 3 months, only for him to learn that skill the next day. Eventually, the Stallworths found a therapist who was a better fit for Kyle, and then their health insurer refused to cover the sessions. For 15 years, we paid every penny of it, Kathleen said. They were fortunate to be able to pay for the sessions out of pocket, though it wasn't easy, given that they had three other children, including a daughter born after Kyle. Kyle was eventually diagnosed with an intellectual disability, a broad diagnosis whose symptoms can look very different from patient to patient. Kyle's issues included language disability, social interaction problems, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and difficulties with memory, motor skills, problem solving, and logical reasoning. Kyle, who is now 40, can't read and depends on his parents for help with many of the tasks of everyday life, including showering, brushing his teeth, and getting dressed. Yet, for all of its detail, the diagnosis offered no explanation for what might have caused Kyle's problems. Stallworth didn't know if his disability was a result of genetic factors or environmental ones. I probably thought about it every day for 39 years, Kathleen said. What happened to Kyle? She pondered every potential contributing factor. She'd been pregnant with Kyle during the summer of 1980, which was one of the hottest on record, so she wondered if the heat had somehow hurt him. She also remembered that when Kyle was an infant, there were reports of tainted baby formula that had caused brain damage in children. Might that have been the cause? For years, Kathleen wondered if she were somehow to blame for Kyle's disability. I can accept what happened, Kathleen said. What I can't accept is not knowing what happened. She and Daryl were at sea on what some doctors call the diagnostic odyssey, a long, torturous search for the cause of an uncommon condition. Then, about 2 years ago, one of Kathleen's friends forwarded an email advertising a study being conducted at Baylor College of Medicine's Human Genome Sequencing Center in Houston. There, researchers were using a relatively new technology, exome sequencing, and focusing on adults with intellectual disabilities who never received a formal diagnosis of a genetic basis for their condition. Kathleen applied, and Kyle was accepted into the study, which was part of an effort to quantify what effect a precise genetic diagnosis would have on adult patients. study was small, limited to 5 patients in the Houston region, and was funded by the center and a private donor, which allowed the testing to be done free of charge. No small thing for some families, given that such tests are expensive and insurance companies often don't cover them. The test itself was simple, anticlimactic, really, after all the years of waiting. The doctors asked Kathleen and Daryl about Kyle's medical history and took saliva samples from all 3 of them. The appointment lasted about an hour. Then the stalwarts waited for the results. Maybe, just maybe, Kathleen thought they would get an answer, but she tried not to get her hopes up too much. If you were to stretch out the DNA found in each human cell and count every single base pair, the units that make up each strand of DNA, you would find 6.4 billion of them. This sequence of base pairs forms the genome, and it acts as a blueprint containing our body's assembly instructions, including how to develop from a single fertilized egg into a full-grown adult, as well as how to construct the machinery that keeps our bodies running smoothly. These 6.4 billion base pairs are, in essence, a doubled set, one from each parent. The two sets are almost identical for nearly everyone. If you were to take 2 random people and look at the sequence of bases in their genomes, about 999 bases out of every 1,000 would be exactly the same. Inheriting a copy from each parent provides a built-in system that can, in some cases, offset missing or broken parts and create just enough variations so that a child will have a blend of traits from both parents. Human Genome Project, an international effort to sequence the genome for the first time, was launched in 1990 and completed its mission in 2003. Its sequencing work cost hundreds of millions of dollars. The technology has improved since then, but sequencing an individual's genome remains an expensive undertaking, one that isn't yet practical for most patients. One way to make the process more accessible is exome sequencing, which was invented a little over a decade ago. Rather than tackling the entire genome, the exome sequencing focuses on the approximately 1.5% of base pairs called exons, the sections that contain the direct instructions for the proteins that form the building blocks and machinery for making our bodies work. Sequencing this part of the genome catches most rare genetic conditions while remaining within the margin of affordability, usually thousands of dollars, though costs vary widely. Since exome sequencing became clinically available in late 2011, it has provided answers to many patients. I never in my wildest dreams thought we would have all these tools, said Dr. Hope Northrup, a medical geneticist at UT Health's McGovern Medical School, who is not associated with the Baylor College of Medicine study. Since the introduction of exome sequencing, Northrup has provided precise diagnoses for dozens of patients and their families, some of whom spent decades searching for answers. Not all patients who undergo exome sequencing will receive a diagnosis. Some mutations lie outside the exome. Others may reside in a part of the exome that is still poorly understood, which makes a small discrepancy easier to miss. Of the 5 patients enrolled in the Baylor pilot study, 3 got a diagnosis. One was Alexa Smith, a 28-year-old Houston resident diagnosed with a rare mutation in the MED13L gene. For her mother, Cindy Smith, the finding was a huge relief, as it offered insights into the symptoms Alexa had exhibited over the years, which, in addition to an intellectual disability, included surprises such as developing cataracts in both eyes when she was 8. This wasn't really a roadmap of medical issues that would come up along the way, Smith said. We just had to deal with things as they came up. Getting this diagnosis meant Smith could have her daughter screened for a heart defect associated with the syndrome. Many syndromes don't occur in isolation, said Dr. Murdoch, a Baylor College of Medicine faculty member who is involved with the study. They don't just affect the brain or development, they can affect other systems like the heart or the kidneys. For some patients, this might mean predisposition to certain types of cancers, which, if screened for and detected early, can be treated more successfully. In late 2019, Kathleen Stallworth finally got the answer she'd waited years to hear. The Baylor doctors discovered that Kyle's condition was caused by a mutation in the TUSC3 gene. This is an extremely rare condition. Known cases worldwide number in the dozens and result from inheriting 2 mutated copies of TUSC3, one from each parent. This mutation is so rare that the chances of a pair of parents both being carriers is akin to buying 2 winning lottery tickets on the same day. Each of the Stallworth's 4 children had a 1 in 4 chance of being born with the condition, and in fact, 1 in 4 was. Kyle's 3 siblings may be carriers, and their 8 children may be carriers too, though none have Kyle's condition. It brought a lot of peace, said Kathleen, who describes crying for days after receiving the test results. Kyle's diagnostic odyssey had come to an end. Now that the Stallworths knew what happened, they could start another journey, one in which they could make sense of his diagnosis. The diagnosis is the key to the room, Northrop said. Get that key, open that door, and there's the room, which in many cases will fill up with other families who can compare notes and offer each other support. Given the rarity of Kyle's syndrome, there's little more than anecdotal evidence about what medications might work for him and what cancers his parents need to look out for. The biggest benefit will come as more and more patients are found to have the same condition. Each new diagnosis offers a chance to build a database of symptoms and conditions observed in each individual and treatments that have been tried. One patient with, say, a certain type of heart defect or rare cancer might be a coincidence. Multiple patients suggest a pattern. Because we're studying adults, this provides the natural history of that syndrome, said Dr. Aniko Sabo, a Baylor faculty member involved with the study. Families wonder, what is my child going to look like when they're 18, when they're 30? What should I look out for? Sometimes the news will offer families hope. Sometimes it will be hard to hear. Either way, knowledge is power, Alexis's mother, Cindy Smith, said. Murdoch and Sabo are expanding the study and a goal of enrolling dozens of patients. If it goes as expected, many of those families will receive diagnoses that will finally resolve years' worth of uncertainty, even if it offers only marginal help for their own situations. For the stalwarts and many other families, these diagnoses don't typically offer the sort of life-changing insights that one might see on a television medical drama or that immediately transform a patient's prospects. They offer a quiet answer with an incremental result. But sometimes a quiet answer, when echoed and multiplied, can build into a life-changing crescendo. As time goes by, there will be more patients with Kyle's syndrome. And when the other families finally reach the end of their own odyssey, when they finally open that door to the diagnosis, Kyle and his family will be there, waiting for them. The author of this piece, Rachel Fairbank, is a Midland-based medical journalist who has written for HuffPost, Lifehacker, and the Houston Chronicle. And since we're on a roll, folks, we're going to stay here with State, and this is still the January issue, and this is Being Texan. It's History by W.K. Stratton, The Battle That Wasn't, How a Texas Ranger's Personal Mythology Came to Be Accepted as Popular History. Early accounts of the Battle of Pease River read like Hollywood film treatments in the 50s. A dashing young hero, Saul Ross, led a small force of Texas Rangers, U.S. cavalry troops, and militia volunteers into combat against a much larger group of Comanche warriors led by legendary Chief Petanacona. It was 160 years ago on December 19, 1860, a frigid, blustery day, and the Rangers' coalition had the element of surprise on its side. The attack was so sudden that a considerable number of Comanche were killed before they could prepare for defense, Ross said years later, in a statement supplied to historian James T. Shields. According to narratives popular at the time, after they defeated the warriors, Ross and another ranger, Tom Killahear, pursued Nakona, a girl, and a woman holding a toddler as they fled on horseback. Ross killed the girl and injured Nakona, then ordered his Mexican servant to dispatch him with a shotgun. Killahear, meanwhile, captured the other woman, whose name was Nadua, and her young daughter. Nadua later told the Americans that she was born Cynthia Ann Parker. 24 years earlier, as a child, Parker had been kidnapped during a bloody raid at her family's compound in Limestone County, 30 miles east of Waco. She was the best-known white captive on the Texas frontier, but by 1860, then in her mid-30s, she had become a Comanche. She was married to Nakona and was the mother of three children, including Quanah Parker, who later became a notable Comanche chief and reservation chief. The attack, and especially the Rangers' capture of the woman who had been Cynthia Ann Parker, was big news in Texas. The event made Ross, just 22 years old, famous. So signal a victory had never before been gained over the fierce and warlike Comanches, DeShields wrote in his 1886 book, Cynthia Ann Parker, The Story of Her Capture. The great Comanche Confederacy was forever broken. Building on his Pease River exploits, Ross went on to serve as Confederate general, Texas state senator, two-term governor, and a president of what is now Texas A&M University, the position he held when he died in 1898. Saul Ross University was also named after him. Ross was inducted into the Texas Ranger Hall of Fame for his skill and courage, but as the popular Pease River narrative has been reexamined in light of long-ignored accounts and other evidence, so has Ross's heroism. One sunny morning this past fall, I left Wichita Falls and traveled northwest to the confluence of Mule Creek and the Pease River in Ford County to meet Ron Parker, the great-grandson of Quanah Parker and the great-great-grandson of Nadua and Petanacona. I wanted to see firsthand the site of this Texas legend. Once I arrived, it did not appear especially monumental. The Pease was not unlike the rivers I grew up around on the plains 200 miles to the north. Soil ranged from red clay to sand, and the tracks of coyotes, feral hogs, and cattle marked the river's banks along its slow-flowing saline waters. Nearby, thickets of mesquite and invasive salt cedars hug Mule Creek, a spring-fed stream. Parker and I followed the cattle trails near the creek and river. We stopped only once when we flushed about 20 wild turkeys from the brush. As we walked on, Parker shared the version of the battle he'd been taught by the Comanche. Pease River was a ranger-led massacre, Parker told me. His great-great-grandfather, Pet the Nakona, he said, was nowhere near the action. At the time, Nakona was with his teenage sons, Quanah and Pecos, and other warriors. Nakona died several years later near the Antelope Hills in Oklahoma, Parker said. He died of an infection. Parker, a Vietnam War vet, is also director of the Quanah Parker Society, headquartered in the nearby Hardeman County town of Quanah, named after his great-grandfather. His version of events definitively contradicts Ross's story and accounts in history books. The same account Ross provided to Shields also appears in John Wesley Wilbarger's Indian Depredations in Texas, published in 1889, which the Texas State Library and Archives Commission deems a valuable chronicle of the decades-long battle for control of Texas, even though the book harshly condemns the Indians and makes no attempt to consider their point of view. A little sidebar here, twice kidnapped. Nedowa died in 1871, 11 years after being recaptured. The Dower Parker people to whom she was restored were utterly alien to her, wrote J. Frank W. in 1926. She belonged to the Comanches, to her children, and to nomadic life on the plains. She died of grief. Back to our text. The more materials I gathered on the events at Pease River, the more credible Parker's version seemed. In an interview in 1928, one of the rangers who took part, Hiram B. Rogers, also described a massacre. I was at the Pease River fight, but I'm not very proud of it. That was not a battle at all, but just a killing of women. I wondered how a massacre had been inflated into a great ranger victory. I would soon learn that Ross himself was largely responsible. Born in 1838, Lawrence Sullivan, Sul Ross, grew up mostly in Waco, which was at the time on the Texas frontier. In 1858, Ross led a Native American auxiliary comprising members of nations friendly with European Americans and hostile to the Comanche, which supported U.S. cavalry troops that fought the Comanche. Ross suffered serious arrow and bullet wounds in a battle near a village of the Wichita people. He reported that the Comanche who shot him was named Mohee, a name Ross would later use in an account of Pease River. Ross completed a college degree in Alabama while he recovered from his injuries. Back in Texas in early 1860, he joined the Rangers just in time to captain a group from Waco in a notoriously inept campaign led by Middleton Tate Johnson to fight the Comanche. Poorly equipped and mismanaged from the first, in the words of historian Walter Prescott Webb, the expedition failed to defeat the warriors. Many of the Rangers drank heavily. Johnson even left his command for a while to get married in Galveston. The Johnson campaign left a blot on Ross's record, one he may have been anxious to remove. Later in 1860, he got his chance when Governor Sam Houston appointed him to raise a ranger company to pursue Comanche who had been raiding white settlements. He recruited 40 men. About 20 U.S. cavalry troopers complemented the rangers. They were also joined by around 90 local militiamen. The subsistence farmers on the frontier of the 1850s feared the Comanche. Just a few decades earlier, the Comanche had ruled over most of what is now the Lone Star State. But you won't see its empire represented among the six flags over Texas' coat of arms at the Capitol. Comanche were warlike and fiercely protective of their turf. They were also entrepreneurs who built the plains economy around their prowess in buffalo hunting and horse breeding. Skilled Comanche diplomats often bested the Spanish and French in negotiations, and their traders dominated fairs in New Mexico and Louisiana. At the turn of the 19th century, some 40,000 tribal members inhabited Comancheria, which stretched across a broad swath of central Texas and through Oklahoma and Kansas. But by the time Ross set out with his rangers in 1860, the Comanche nation was in steep decline. Drought, starvation, and disease imported by floods of European Americans had reduced their population to about 5,000. Beginning in the 1850s, the Comanche conducted vicious raids on the Texas frontier. As Ross and his troops made their way northwest toward the Red River, they found a Bible and other items that had been taken from farmsteads. Ross took this to mean he was on the trail of Comanche raiders. On December 19th, he found Comanche encamped on Mule Creek, about a quarter to a half mile above its mouth on the Pease River. Landscapes changed over time, especially somewhere like the Pease River country. But when Parker and I followed a cow path to a flat area along Mule Creek, where there was room for horses to graze and where banks rose on each side, providing protection from the wind, I was able to envision a scene. By the time I visited the site, I'd researched enough to know the undisputed facts of what had happened there. The Rangers and cavalry attacked. The militia's men's horses were too jaded or weary, so they did not participate. When it was over, Nadewa, her young daughter, and a Comanche boy were taken captive. The bodies of a few slain Comanche lay on the frozen ground. It was likely that a handful of Comanche, maybe six, had escaped. Ross's cohort suffered no casualties. Rangers round up about 30 horses and mules. Four women were among the dead. Three males, likely still boys, also died. Everything took place in just a matter of minutes. As he sought public office in the years after the Civil War, Ross embellished details of the event so that he would appear more heroic. Ranching legend Charles Goodnight, who inspired the character Woodrow Call and Lonesome Dove, once dubbed Ross a lying four-flusher, an old-fashioned term for someone who makes empty claims for personal gain. To learn more about the four-flusher, I then drove 200 miles to the house of retired attorney and former Hood County District Judge Tom Crum on the Brazos River southeast of Granbury. Crum has spent more than 25 years researching the 1860 massacre. He located 9 accounts Ross gave, all different. He'd be the ideal person to have on the witness stand, Crum said, until he gets cross-examined. Crum and I spent 2 afternoons going over the collection of primary and secondary sources he and his friend Paul Carlson, an emeritus history professor at Texas Tech, used when co-writing a book about the day, Myth, Memory, and Massacre, Pease River Capture of Cynthia Ann Parker. Eventually, Crum loaded my car down with stacks of material to take home. Most compelling resource was a fat 3-ring binder containing hundreds of pages of single-spaced typed text, a first-hand record of 19th-century Texas events by a man named John Hamilton Baker. John Hamilton Baker arrived in Texas in the 1850s intending to become a teacher. He opened a school in Palo Pinto, 56 miles west of Fort Worth, and then established the town's first Methodist church before relocating to Granbury, almost 40 miles southeast. He also began keeping a diary and continued to do so for 60 years. Baker rode with the militia that supported Ross's Rangers and cavalry troopers, and he recorded what happened on the river as a witness. After the shooting died down, Baker reported the militiamen encountered Ross on the Pease. Ross shouted that he and his party had come across 15 Comanche, killing 12 and taking 3 as captive. The militia members hurried up Mule Creek as fast as worn-out horses could carry them. "We found only 4 dead Indians, all women," Baker wrote. Baker also saw Nadewa, her daughter, and a young Comanche boy, whom Ross would take home with him and name Pease Ross, but there was no sign of the 8 other Comanche Ross claimed to have killed. Baker reported that about 30 Comanche horses and mules received, seized, some of which the militiamen recognized as stock stolen from farmers. The next day, Baker wrote in his diary that the militiamen found 3 more dead Comanche, all male. Baker doesn't specify their ages, but it is likely, based on Oxford professor Pekka Hämäläinen's definitive The Comanche Empire, that 2 were boys, maybe as young as 10, who had the job of taking care of the horses in accordance with the traditional Comanche division of responsibilities. 3rd may have been an adult mistaken for a chief. Baker counted a total of 7 dead, not the dozen Ross claimed. Baker also reported that as many as 6 Comanche escaped. June 1875, Galveston News published a letter from Ross detailing the correct history of what happened on Mule Creek. He misstated the date as December 18th, which led to decades of mistakes in Pease River accounts by other writers. Ross had become more creative in the years since the event. This time, he said a chief named Mohee was present and professed that he fought him mano a mano, killing him. Mohee, the name that Ross applied to the Comanche who shot him at the Battle of the Wichita Village, apparently slain there by one of Ross's fellow rangers, had come back to life, only to die once more on Mule Creek. In this account of Ross's, the number of Comanche horses scattered or killed 12 to 350. Eventually, Ross morphed Mohee into Petanacona and said he, Ross, had directed the Comanche's death on Mule Creek. Crum and Parker are certain, however, that Nakona was not killed at Pease River. Quanah Parker said on several occasions that his father died in the mid-1860s. U.S. Army interpreter Horace P. Jones, who worked at Camp Cooper in Texas and Fort Cobb in Indian Territory and who knew Nakona, said he spoke to Nakona at Fort Cobb more than a year after Pease River Massacre. At the time Ross's letter to the Galveston News was published, Reconstruction was winding down in the South. Former Confederates like Ross were making their way back into public life. Ross had become sheriff of McLennan County in 1873, but he had grander political ambitions. He resigned 2 years later and was elected as a delegate to the 1875 Texas Constitutional Convention. In 1880, he ran for state senate and won. By 1885, he was eyeing a race for governor. Contemporary Ross has said it was the Pease River fight to capture Cynthia Ann Parker that made Sol Ross governor of Texas. Victor Rose, a journalist from Victoria who had served under Ross during the Civil War, played a role in helping his former commander publicize his slant on the Pease River incident. In correspondence, Ross thanked Rose for the way the journalist dressed up Ross's stories. He directed Rose to get the Pease River accounts published in newspapers not as advertisements but as news or editorials. Crum, in his book, suggests that Ross was concerned the public would detect the political motive in an advertorial. "I'm satisfied the publication of this would swell my vote greatly," Ross wrote to Rose. "I did not dig up any additional accounts from Ross in newspapers after 1875, but he found a more effective method to spread the story." The Shield's popular book, Cynthia Ann Parker, appeared just in time for the governor's election in 1886. The book contained Ross's entire multi-page statement about Pease River. According to the statement, it was a major battle and many warriors were killed. Ross was responsible for the death of Peta Nakona, and Cynthia Ann Parker was heroically recovered. Ross handily won the election. Moreover, DeShields' account of Pease River came to be accepted as the standard. Of such stuff, author John Graves once wrote of the incident, "Are true myths built? And among the myths we Texans have, the Parker story is one of the most potent of all." Ross certainly understood the power of his own mythology. And that very conveniently brings us to the end of our reading for today. You've been listening to Texas Monthly Magazine, Saturday afternoons at 5 and Monday afternoons at 2 on Sight and Sound Broadcasting, your print information.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Travelin' Texas, followed by Texas Gardener at 4:30.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
The Midland Health Department is providing clinical services by appointment only. Appointments will be scheduled from 8:15 a.m. to 3:45 p.m. Monday through Friday. In addition, the Health Department will have an immunization clinic 8:15 a.m. to 6 p.m. Monday. Appointments are required for immunizations. To schedule an appointment, call 681-7613.
Sunday afternoons, we take you around the Lone Star State for 3 hours, starting at 2 p.m. with Texas Monthly Archives. At 3, it's the current issue of Texas Monthly Magazine. At 4, Travelin' Texas. And at 4:30, Texas Gardener. Sunday afternoons, beginning at 2, on Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 61 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 40s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the upper 50s. Tomorrow night, it will be cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 4 p.m.
Hello and welcome to our program. My name is Lynette McLamory, and I'll be reading Traveling Texas here on Sight into Sound Radio. For today's program, I'll be reading articles off of the website of Texas Highways, and our first one is titled New Year, New Marfa, Which Texas Towns Are Ready to Eclipse the Tiny Art Haven. After years of reigning as the hippest small town in Texas, Marfa has some competition. Written by Michael Corcoran. The next Marfa is the small town Texas version of the New Dillon. So easily is it tossed around and eventually dismissed. The truth is, there will probably never be another town with a population of less than 2,000 in the Lone Star State that draws an international art crowd. Marfa is not Marfa because Giant was filmed there, or because the town has made a tourist attraction from mysterious lights bouncing on the horizon of a highway. No, this boomtown in the boonies has a private jet runway for the likes of Beyoncé, because the late famous artist Donald Judd moved his operation from Soho in New York City to Marfa in the 1970s and made the High Plains his gallery. Visitors come from all over the world to see Judd mock minimalism with gigantic installations, not for the fabulous Marfalafel at Food Shark. If Andy Warhol relocated his notorious Manhattan studio, The Factory, to the Lone Star State, folks would have called Marfa the next Paris, Texas. Why Paris? First, the humor of art trekking to Paris after renting a car in Dallas is decidedly Warholian. Second, Paris is the home of the Campbell Soup Company in Texas, so the town could really roll out the tomato-colored carpet. But since that didn't happen, we can only search for towns with Marfa-esque qualities. Here are a few picks to become hip havens for artists. Waxahachie, population 35,362. Waxahachie has been a film hotbed since 1967's Bonnie and Clyde. Native son Robert Benton co-wrote the Oscar-winning film, which was also shot there. The screenwriter really showed off his hometown with Places in the Heart, the 1985 film that won Sally Field a Best Actress Oscar and put Victorian farmhouses on What's Hot lists. We like you, Waxahachie. We really like you, even though the artistic focus has moved to painting and sculpting. The town's art scene is centered around the spacious and welcoming Webb Gallery, opened by former Dallas punk rockers Bruce and Julie Webb in 1987. With 5,000 square feet of gallery space, the Webb is known for a heavy carnival art flavor that Julie calls hobolore. However, even though Waxahachie's octagon-shaped Chautauqua Auditorium, built in 1902, is cooler than any venue in West Texas, its chances of becoming the next Marfa are slim. Remoteness is key, and medium W is just too close to big D. Odds of becoming next Marfa, 25-1. Wimberley, population about 2,700. Let's move our attention to the Texas Hill Country town of Wimberley, situated on the Blanco River in Hays County. Like Marfa, this is a town you don't drive through to go to any place else. Both are destinations, period. But Wimberley is ruled by water and wine, not art. Folks go to the unofficial wind chime capital of Central Texas, as I like to call it, to swim and sip. And why not? When you have Blue Hole Regional Park and Jacob's Well, both within 10 minutes of the town, you're going to want to take a dip. And maybe pick up some stained glass memento in the shape of Texas while shopping in the bustling town square. As for curious attractions, the depth of Jacob's Well is about as mysterious as it gets. Odds of becoming next Marfa, 15-1. Calvert, population 1,192. A dark horse in the race to be the next great artiest little town in Texas is Calvert, on State Highway 6, directly between Waco and Bryan College Station. It's a working-class hamlet of about 1,000, with big old buildings barking to be rescued and transformed. Downtown looks like an Old West movie set, except there are great restaurants, such as Cast Iron Bistro, two art galleries, and Farm to Market Coffee. Sean Starr, a sign painter and visual artist, moved his studio to Calvert from Taylor, where the real estate market thinks it's Marfa, 2 years ago. At the same time, we were purchasing our building. An artist from Oregon and one from New York also bought buildings downtown, he says. This is how an art scene starts. Calvert still has a ways to go to equaling the Marfa mystique, but you never know. Neopop artist Jeff Koons could start making his giant, shiny balloon animals in this Robertson County town. Then the race would be all over. Odds of becoming next Marfa, 8-1. And now our next article, Crossing to Safety, How Driver Attention and Innovative Design Can Help Protect Wildlife. Vehicles kill an incalculable number of animals on Texas roadways every year. Written by Del Weissman. I'm out riding a motorcycle one drizzly Saturday morning in late November, tracing familiar back roads from my Austin home to Blanco and back. During my 125-mile ride, something other than bucolic scenery catches my eye. Roadkill. The tally: a dead white-tailed deer, a mangled feral hog, a raccoon in stuffed toy-like repose, and a gray fox lying in the road as if peacefully asleep. Cruising at highway speeds, I likely missed many smaller traffic casualties, rodents, birds, reptiles, and amphibians. On other hill country rides, I've spotted scores of dead animals, mostly deer, as well as clusters of vultures cleaning up carcasses. I'm not out searching for roadkill carnage. It's just inescapable. Before the rise of the automobile in the early 20th century, there was no concept of roadkill. The term was likely coined in the late 1950s or early 1960s when Americans flocked to the expanding interstate highway system. Iowa biologist Dayton Stoner published the first scientific study of the phenomenon, The Toll of the Automobile, in Science magazine in 1925. The field of road ecology emerged in the late 1990s as biologists began studying how highways fragment natural habitats and create barriers to animal movement. Rather than the term roadkill, road ecologists prefer wildlife vehicle conflict, or WVC, or dead on road, DOR, animal. WVC numbers are incalculable. Researchers rely on systematic surveys, citizen science input, insurance claims, and police reports to estimate the scale of wildlife mortality. State Farm estimates U.S. drivers have a 1 in 116 chance of a collision with an animal. Drivers filed nearly 2 million animal collision insurance claims in the U.S. between mid-2019 and mid-2020. According to Federal Highway Administration data, from 1 million to 2 million large animals are killed by vehicles in the U.S. each year. Factor in small animals that often go unnoticed, and the annual toll scales much higher. Texas drivers report nearly 8,000 crashes a year involving wildlife or domestic animals, and the actual number may be 5 to 10 times higher than reported to law enforcement, according to a 2019 report by the Center for Transportation Research at the University of Texas at Austin. Approximately 20 people die each year on Texas roads in these collisions,